This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Bone Music by Christopher Rice, performed by Lauren Ezzo. To Jackie Ben-Zechri and Eric Shaw Quinn, who helped bring Charlotte to life over a fateful last-minute lunch in Seattle. They didn't plan to kill my mother. She wasn't like the other women, the ones they stalked and captured. The ones who came to in a cold root cellar miles from where they'd been abducted, hog-tied and disoriented, their faces pressed to the dirt floor. My mother wasn't like those victims. She was an accident. A flat tire and a rainstorm conspired to place her in their path. And by the time Daniel Banning had reached through the passenger window of her Cecilia and placed his stun gun to the side of her neck, they still hadn't noticed the baby in the back seat. When they did, their choices narrowed. Leave me by the side of the road, along with all the forensic evidence that might involve, or add a 9-month-old girl to their list of victims. People have made so much of the fact that two of the most notorious serial killers in American history couldn't bring themselves to kill a baby. It blinded them to what the Bannings really did to me, which on some days seems much worse. Did I cry that night? I still don't know if my infant brain sensed their evil, sensed the wrongness in the sounds my mother made when the electricity surged through her body before she went ragdoll limp across the steering wheel. To this day, to any interviewer that will listen, Abigail insists I didn't. Daniel hung himself in prison before he went to trial. She's told three of her biographers I was silent and docile as she peeled me out of the car seat and shielded me from the rain with one open flap of her coat. To hear her tell it, I barely cried at all during the 7 years she and her husband groomed me to be a killer. I remember the mobile made of stars and half-moons they hung over my baby bed. I remember them carrying me across the cow pasture, pausing so I could run my hands along silky flanks and marvel at how oblivious those great beasts seemed to the touch of my tiny fingers. There were horses, too, but their long, angular heads and great huffing breaths frightened me, and I didn't feel the same affection for them as I did for the cows. I remember Daniel taking me to a wooded hillside so blanketed with ferns he used them as a kind of slide and sent my little body gliding downhill. It felt almost like flight, and I squealed and threw my arms skyward into the diamonds of sunlight filtering through the dense branches above. I remember the day I sneaked out of the house, ran clear across the pasture, and after stumbling a few paces into the woods, came across the root cellar for the first time. I remember the explosion of force from someone throwing themselves against the other side of the door half buried in the hillside. I remember the low, keening sounds, the whispers, the begging. And I remember thinking that it made no sense for someone who sounded grown-up to be begging for anything from a child as young as me. Then Abigail came running. She scooped me up as if I weighed nothing and carried me back toward the house. I would like to believe there was some desire in her to protect me from the horrors taking place on that farm, but she was simply biding her time until she could present those horrors in the correct way, in a manner that would allow me to find my own role and purpose in them. That day, the day I found the root cellar, is like a tent stake that anchors a swirl of memories. Because it was around that time that the lies started, and the burnings. People came at night, they told me. People came at night while we were sleeping to steal the cows. And sometimes Daniel and Abigail would have to chase these people. And when they chased them, sometimes these people dropped their belongings. Their purses, their watches, their phones, and their rings. Because these people had come to steal something of ours, it wasn't right for us to return their belongings to them, was it? It was time, they said, for me to start learning about the wrongness of other people, the badness of people who came to harm the special place we had on the farm. It was time for me to start using the incinerator. Abigail placed a plastic tub of wallets, watches, and jewelry in my small hands and followed close behind me as we crossed the field. Until then, they had taught me to steer clear of the strange machine, which looked as if someone had removed the smokestack and front part of a locomotive and set it just behind the barn. That first time, Abigail picked me up by the waist so I could drop the tub's contents inside the chamber. Then she turned and held me up to the control panel so I could start the burning. The second time, a stepladder was waiting for us when we got there, and she stood back, beaming with pride, as I dropped two leather wallets and three slender gold watches into the chamber below. A spread of photographs in plastic cases slid free of one wallet as it thunked against the chamber's bottom. When I peered farther in to see who the pictures were of, Abigail jerked me back. She didn't want me to look too closely at the life she was compelling me to erase. She was so proud when I was done that she picked me up and kissed me. I remember the feeling that I was contributing to the specialness of our home, that I had somehow helped keep it pure, that I had kept the cows from being stolen in the night. There was no way for me to know that the nickname that would follow me for the rest of my life was born in that moment. Imagine witnessing a murder before you know what death is. When parents explain death to their children, they are, even if they don't intend to, giving every life equal value, equal weight. They're saying we all end the same, no matter who we are or what we have acquired in the interim. Even a 7-year-old can understand this. Daniel and Abigail Banning didn't do that for me. Instead, they taught me that all living things could be broken up into 3 groups. Those that provided us with something, the cows and their milk, for instance. Those that provided us with nothing and could be extinguished without thought, like the bluebird whose neck Abigail broke with her bare hands while she and Daniel studied my reaction. And then there was a 3rd group, the corruptors, the living things who would try to steal from us, take from us, turn us against our better selves, like the people who came in the night to take the cows, the ones who dropped their watches and purses in their haste to get away. It was their job, as my mother and father, they said, to teach me how to deal with all 3. In some respects, they were like other parents. They masked what they thought to be hard truth inside a fabric of comforting lies. In their view, the corruptors were not cow thieves. They were the women Daniel Banning blamed for his abominable appetites. Women like Lila Turlington. They followed Lila and her boyfriend, Eddie Stevens, for 2 days as the couple backpacked along the Appalachian Trail, before approaching their campground around dusk, posing as 2 hikers in search of company, earning their trust, before beating Eddie to death with a large rock and binding Lila with nylon rope. Women like Cassie Murdoch and Jane Blair, the 2 road-tripping University of Georgia students they struck up a conversation with at a roadside diner, so they could find out which motel cabin they were spending the night in. They broke into their room while they slept and beat Cassie and Jane so swiftly and savagely, the poor girls might have mistaken the first few seconds of the assault for a nightmare before they were knocked unconscious. These were the real corruptors they sought to cleanse from the earth, the women Daniel Banning had an overwhelming desire to rape, a desire Abigail would allow him to indulge for 3 days, before she went down to the root cellar with a knife and cut his victim's throat. But not before whispering in her ear, "You are now nothing." Today Cassie and Jane are buried almost side by side at Oak Lawn Cemetery in New Orleans, their hometown. Eddie and Lila are in a small woodsy cemetery in Asheville, North Carolina. I've visited them at least 2x. I've been to visit all the victims at least once. All the people they killed during my time at the farm. To prepare me for my first kill, they set bird traps through the branches that surrounded the path we took on our sunset walks, small steel cages that glinted amid the foliage. Because I had watched them kill 4 birds with their bare hands, I now saw birds as a nuisance, their skittish flight evidence of some mania or disease. But when Abigail reached inside one of the traps and placed the chirping creature in my tiny hands, cautioning me to grip it tightly so it wouldn't fly away, a resistance rose in me, as primal and fundamental as thirst. At least, that's how I choose to remember it. That something deep within me, something untouched by the Bannings and their evil, was still alive, and that this fundamental goodness prevented me from taking that bird's life. But truth be told, I'll never know for sure. For that was the precise moment when men dressed entirely in black, their goggles and helmets reflecting the evening sun, burst from the woods on all sides of us, ordering us to hit the ground, face down, hands up. For an instant, their long guns were like fingers of darkness sprouting from the shadows. Daniel and Abigail made sounds I'd never heard them make before. Not just cries of alarm, but furious wails and profanity I wouldn't learn the meaning of until later. A boot heel pressed Abigail's face to the leaf-strewn soil. Daniel made a run for it before he was tackled to the ground. I was knocked backward and dragged away, the bluebird alighting from my suddenly open hands. What saved its life? My refusal to kill? Or chance? I wish I knew for sure. Part 1. In light of the conflicting and, in many cases, inaccurate press accounts of a recent event in the Burnham College Talk series, the program coordinators have decided to post both a partial and a full transcript of the event to their website. The partial transcript appears below. Of Human Monsters, a talk with Lowell Pierce and his daughter, Trina Pierce, discussing their best-selling book of the same title, as well as the Savage Woods films the book inspired. Burnham College, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Excerpt. Audience Member 1. Mr. Pierce, we've certainly heard a lot from you today, but we haven't heard much from your daughter, and so I'd like to direct this question to her. LP. Sure, of course. Audience Member 1. So, this week, the 5th film in the Savage Woods franchise was released, and while it's common knowledge these films are based on your TP. They're not based on my experiences. Audience Member 1. Right. But, I mean, not literally, but they're inspired by... I guess what I'm saying is, if you'd been forced, I mean, they were holding you hostage, so it's not like people wouldn't understand if they made you... TP. Are you asking me if I killed someone on that farm? Audience Member 1. I'm asking you if what we saw in the first Savage Woods film might have some more basis in reality than you've been willing to discuss. TP. So you're asking me if I shoved someone into an incinerator while they were alive, when I was 7. LP. Trina, let's just... TP. Let's just what, Dad? I mean, again? Again with this question? LP. Inaudible. TP. Inaudible. No. The answer's no, I've never killed anyone. The movie's a bunch of lies, it doesn't have anything to do with me at all. Audience Member 1. But it was based on your life, I mean... Moderator. All right, maybe there are some other questions that can steer us back toward the book so we can focus on... TP. It was based on a book my father wrote about my life when I was 8. Murmurs on stage. Inaudible. Crowd noises. LP. What Trina means, is that in order to give you an accurate picture of what she went through at the time, a lot of us had to work together to make the book a reality. There was not only the matter of her age, but also the trauma she'd been through, and TP. Translation, I had nothing to do with that book. LP. Well, of course you didn't. You were only 8 years old. I mean, an 8-year-old can't write a book. Moderator. Do we have another question? Audience member 2. Yes, I mean, is it okay to ask about the movies, like, at all? Laughter. TP. No. More laughter. TP. No. I mean, whatever your question about the movies is, the answer's no. No, I haven't spent my life being stalked by the Bannings' cannibal cousins, because the Bannings weren't cannibals and they didn't have any cousins. And no, everyone I get close to isn't horribly murdered. Audience member 2. Okay. But is it true you die in this one? TP. Fingers crossed. Laughter. Some applause. LP. Trina, that's enough. Why don't we... TP. Is it enough, though, Dad? Is it finally enough? Can we finally stop doing this every time a new movie comes out? Moderator. Okay. Now I'm confident that someone out there has some questions about the book, which presents some very valuable, if harrowing, lessons on how we can spot and avoid psychopaths who might seek to... LP. Exactly. Why don't we take one more question about the book, and then we'll begin the book signing. There's a hand up in the back, I think. Audience member 3. So, Burning Girl. TP. Don't call me that. Audience member 3. Excuse me? TP. I said, don't call me that name. Crowd noises. Scattered boos. Audience member 3. I wasn't going to call you that. I was just bringing it up as an example. Okay. You know what? This is cute and all, like this little display, I guess you'd call it. But you've been profiting off what happened to you for almost a decade now. I'm just wondering where all this self-righteousness comes from all of a sudden. Why are you upset now? Light applause. TP. I've been profiting? You do know I'm 16, right? Laughter. LP. Okay, that's enough. Look, Trina and I have devoted our lives to turning her terrible experience into a set of tools people can use to avoid falling prey to monsters like the Bannings. This is our life's work. It always will be. Now, as I have said repeatedly, we can't be held responsible for the creative license Hollywood takes with Trina's story. We're not producers on the Savage Woods films. We never granted script approval, so it simply isn't... TP. He gets a percentage of the gross. Do you guys know how that works? It's a Hollywood thing. LP. Trina. TP. If they promise you a percentage of the net, you'll never get anything because they've got accountants who can make it look like the movie never made a profit. But if you get part of the gross, you always get paid. He gets a part of the gross on every Savage Woods movie, including the one where I supposedly shoved someone in an incinerator. Where are you going, Dad? Lowell Pierce removes his microphone and leaves the stage. TP. It was supposed to be a mini-series, you see. Real fact-based, true to life. But then they came to him and they said it would make a lot more money as a horror movie franchise. They could make them real cheap. They wouldn't have to cast any stars, maybe pump out a lot of sequels. And he said yes as long as they gave him a cut of the profits, as long as he could quit his job. Cheap torture porn about his own daughter. That's his life's work. And mine too, apparently. Now, are there any other questions before I go vomit like I always do after these things? Audience member 3. Yeah, I got one. Why are you such a bitch?
TP.
I don't know. Why are you a basement-dwelling psychopath who gets a boner watching women get tortured?
Inaudible outburst. Sound equipment distortions. Security escorts Trina Pierce off stage.
1.
Jason Briffle reads the transcript again. His hands are shaking. If anyone inside this roadside diner notices how badly he's sweating, they'll probably blame the baking desert heat outside. But it's not the heat. It's the same full-body reaction he experiences every time he reads the 10-year-old record of the last time Trina appeared on stage with her birth father. Normally, the transcript focuses him, which is why he picked it up after the plate of steak and eggs in front of him failed to ignite his appetite. He thought it would collect his scattered thoughts, channel his anxiety and doubt into action. It's been 7 years since he showed up on the doorstep of her grandmother's house in California. Even longer since he mailed her those letters explaining how her birth father and her so-called rescue by the authorities had averted her true destiny. Her soul was being starved. Together, the two of them could reawaken that exceptional and enlightened young girl Daniel and Abigail Banning had coaxed into being. But today, the transcript hadn't worked its usual magic. Reading it has left him angry and confused. He's gripped now by the humiliating memory of what happened to him that fateful night in Burnham College. He's feeling the vice grip of the two blazer-clad security guards who'd appeared out of nowhere right after he entered the auditorium. The ones who'd threatened to call the cops as they carried him out so quickly he could practically feel the wind in his hair. A hopeful, perhaps foolish, part of him had been convinced that someone in Trina's inner circle would have seen the wisdom in his letters. Abigail Banning certainly had. Unlike Trina, who responded to his attempts at honest communication with a restraining order, Abigail replied in great detail to every single letter Jason mailed her at Haddock Penitentiary. She recognized Jason as the vehicle for her adopted daughter's restoration. A daughter who'd been divinely gifted to her, and then cruelly removed by a world that did not understand the spiritual necessity of life-taking. Abigail blessed Jason with words he'd been desperate to hear since he'd first laid eyes on Trina. "You will be the Daniel to her Abigail," she'd written. "And in so doing, you will become my son too." Why hadn't he read that letter instead of this transcript? He's brought it with him, along with several others. They're at the bottom of his backpack, along with the coil of rope, the rolls of duct tape, and the Ziploc bags in which he plans to put the bullets he's going to strip from the 3 different guns she keeps in her house. Should he read it now? No. There's no telling what effect it might have on him. Instead, he searches the diner for corruptors. There's one sitting a few tables away, pretty and young, with a blonde ponytail and a halter top that reveals just enough suntanned skin to corrupt. She taps at the screen of her smartphone. The mustached man sitting across from her gazes out at the passing 18-wheelers with a vacant stare that reveals all the damage she's done to his soul. She ignores the man on purpose. Jason knows this. That morning, or possibly the night before, she denied the man sex and took great, silent delight in the pain this caused him. Right now, she's texting a girlfriend, or maybe several, and they're reveling in the power she lords over the man, in the pain her withholding creates in him. And she does this because she is a corrupter, one of many. And once Jason has awakened Trina to their combined destiny, she will give herself entirely to their union and help him remove women like this blonde whore from the earth. Trina will burn away the evidence of his work, just like she burned away the detritus of Abigail and Daniel's victims. But first, he has to break down her walls,
Show her there's no escape. From her true calling. From her real mother. From him. These thoughts, these plans, this vision finally give him the confidence he's been seeking since he stopped off at this diner. He has only a few hours left in his drive, a few hours until he'll reach the isolated parcel of Arizona desert she now calls home. Today is a day like no other, and it will require a great deal more strength and confidence than it did to write those letters. Because a few months ago, all those years of not knowing where she'd disappeared to came to an abrupt end, thanks to a single, miraculous email. As thrilled as he'd been to have the information, the knowledge brought with it a distinct challenge, to return to the mission he'd almost given up on entirely, to stoke the flames that would turn Trina into Burning Girl once again. As for the name she calls herself now, he must never let it pass through his lips. He would be doing her a disservice if he did. His job is to free her of her delusions, not strengthen them. So he avoids thinking it now. To him, she will always be Trina Pierce. And if he succeeds this time, she will become his Burning Girl. 2.
Charlotte, why don't you step away from the window?
She knows it's a good idea. Most of Dr. Thorpe's suggestions have been good ideas. Or at least the 30% she's willing to try. It's true. If she doesn't stop staring at the movie theater across the street, she won't be able to focus on his advice. But a crazy part of her believes that if she turns her back on the bold cluster of words on the old school marquee, they'll somehow strike at her, like a snake. They're the same words that stopped her in her tracks when she first saw them, that have turned every night for the past 2 weeks into a prolonged battle with terrible dreams. Halloween double feature. Savage Woods and Savage Woods 2. The Reckoning. The Blake is a restored movie house, one of the new jewels of Scarlet, this tiny, once-abandoned mining town in the Arizona desert, turned hippie enclave and aspiring tourist trap. Its stucco facade is painted a shade of hunter green that, from a distance, makes it look like an oasis rising from the parched Sonoran desert. At night, the vertical neon sign that spells out the theater's name is visible for miles around. At dusk, however, the sign looks skeletal and hungry, the unlit neon letters casting spidery shadows along its length. And then there are the posters flanking the ticket booth, the same blood-dripping art that used to stare back at her from the t-shirts worn by all those horror movie fans who'd pack the house at the events she used to do with her father.
Okay,
Dylan says.
Then describe what you're seeing right now.
A movie theater, she says.
Is that all?
Invasion. Injustice.
Fear?
He asks. That too. The girl on the poster looks very afraid, just like she always does.
The girl that's supposed to be you.
Well, she doesn't look like me. Her hair's still brown, for one, and I've got about 15 pounds on her. They changed some of the letters in her name, so there's that. One in the first, one in the last. My father saw to that part, you know, 'cause he's such a kind, considerate, selfish mother... Sorry.
Since when did I say you couldn't curse?
Well, if you had, I'd probably just do it anyway and then leave.
You're free to leave at any time, you know that.
I do.
But I wish you wouldn't, Charlotte.
I wish you'd keep talking.
Honestly, it's easier when you try to read my mind.
She sits, looks at him for the first time since she stormed into his cramped office, which always smells of burnt coffee from the AA meetings downstairs.
It's not easy looking Dylan Thorpe in the eyes, and not just because he's basically appointed himself her psychiatrist now,
It's hard because he's one of the most astonishingly handsome men she's ever seen. The kind of handsome that seems two-dimensional and unreal, even when it's sitting across from you, like it might slide from view if you swipe up on your phone. Another woman, a woman without Charlotte's walls, might have tried to seduce him after their first chat downstairs, even after it became clear that he'd sought her out as a kind of pet project. By his own admission, Dylan had sensed she didn't truly belong in the AA meetings at the Saguaro Wellness Center, that she gravitated to them because there was something about the sharing, all those honest, unguarded expressions of hopes, insecurities, and fears, that quieted her soul, even though she'd never been what anyone would call an alcoholic. It would take another few weeks before Charlotte admitted she liked the meetings because they made her feel close to her late grandmother, with whom she'd lived for almost a decade after fleeing her father. They were both survivors, she and her grandmother. The woman almost drank herself to death following the disappearance of her daughter and grandchild. But, even before Charlotte's rescue, Trina's rescue, if they were going to be technical about it, Luann found sobriety and became a pillar of the small 12-step community in Altamira, a little town just south of Big Sur, and a short drive inland from the Pacific Coast Highway, a place she'd called home for 30 years. After Charlotte went to live with her, Luann made a habit of bringing her to the open AA meetings in town, the ones that allowed non-alcoholics to just sit and listen. That's where Charlotte first heard slogans like, "First things first, easy does it," and her personal favorite, "Keep it simple, stupid." That's where she had seen that people really could change, that we're not all doomed by our genetics or our pasts. The 8 years she'd spent with her grandmother, 3 of them as an almost normal high school student, and the rest as an assistant manager in Luann's pet supply store, were the happiest in her entire life. Idyllic, compared with what came before and after. The long walks they took together along Altamira's rocky coast, the open skies that were often filled by great, towering clouds, the steadiness of her grandmother's grip, and the quiet wisdom of her recovery, even the biting chill of the Pacific winds. All these things made her time on the Bannings farm seem like a memory so distant, it might one day fade entirely. Then, one afternoon, walking home from the store, Grandma Luann died of a sudden, massive heart attack. A quick and painless death, but one that tore a hole in Charlotte so deep she could barely speak for weeks afterward. This is what it means to have a real family, she'd realized as they lowered the casket into the ground. This is part of loving and being loved, and without it, you cannot have the other parts, the joyful parts. In her will, Luann left Charlotte her house and the small pet supply store she'd run for 30 years. 6 months later, one of the big chains opened in the next valley over, close to the 101 freeway. Sales dropped precipitously. Her grandmother's AA friends chipped in what they could, but it was obvious that even selling her grandmother's house would not be enough to keep the store afloat. When her father refused to help, Charlotte snapped. Desperate, she decided it was time to demand at least a respectable portion of the money she'd earned for him over the years, something she could use to start a new life. And it was time to demand it with a lawyer. She won, but her victory came with the sad realization that there was a lot less money saved than her father had led everyone to believe. Still, she got enough to pay for a legal name change and her house outside Scarlet. In short, combined with the sale of her grandmother's house, she managed to get just enough money out of him to become Charlotte Rowe. In the 3 months since they started these chats, she shared all this with Dylan. She doesn't harbor any delusions about him, about what their sessions mean to him. She's just something rough and real for him to cut his teeth on after years of listening to big-city, high-paying clients whine about their perfect lives. And she's fine with that. It keeps her safe, installs the kind of boundaries and structure her life has always lacked.
But still, there are moments. Moments when the heroes in the Nora Roberts novel she reads before bed start to look like Dylan in her mind. Or when her hands start to wander under the sheet as she wonders what things would be like if she wasn't quite her, and he wasn't quite him, and her past was someone else's. When she reminds herself that she's just a hard luck case, then Dylan's good looks don't inspire childish romantic fantasies in her. Instead, his twinkling blue eyes, determined jaw, and short, jet-black hair, which he always keeps combed to one side like some TV dad from the 1950s, are just additional reminders that he's passing through, while she plans to hide out here for as long as she can. And it was all going so well, she thinks, until the Blake decided to have a Halloween film festival.
Okay, then. Well, is it safe to say you assumed that by moving to a town as small as Scarlet, you'd never have to look at that poster again?
Something like that, yeah. And technically I don't live here.
Your grocery store is here,
he answers.
And your P.O. box.
And you.
Exactly. So it's got to feel as if they're getting ready to play that movie just down the street from where you live, even though it's a 45-minute drive.
Movies.
Plural.
Exactly.
Go deeper, Charlie.
It gives her a warm feeling, the way he says even the shortened version of her new name. Charlotte is what her grandmother wanted to name her when she was born, and Roe is the last name of a Canadian author who wrote a vampire novel her grandmother had loved. What does that mean, Dr. Thorpe?
It means you call me Dr. Thorpe when I ask you to do something you don't want to do.
What are you asking me to do, Dylan?
Spell out how you feel, without judgment, so that we can walk you back to a healthier perspective together one step at a time.
Okay. I feel like the movies are a sign someone knows I'm here.
Even though you changed your name. Even though you live behind the kind of security system that's usually used to protect bars of gold.
And the guns, don't forget about the guns.
The point, Charlotte, is that when I asked you to describe what you were seeing out the window, you used the word invasion.
Did I?
You did, yes. Is that an accurate description of what you feel when you look at that marquee?
Yes, she answers.
So it's safe to say that what you're feeling now is akin to what you felt when Jason Briffle made threats against you in the past.
Like ice water in her face, hearing the guy's name again. Do we have to use his real name? She asks.
What would you like us to call him?
I don't know, maybe we can come up with some term for him, some nickname.
How about we just call him your stalker?
Maybe something more, I don't know, benign?
I'd caution you against downplaying it. Dismissing the seriousness of the letters he sent to you and Abigail Banning won't make you stronger.
I'm not dismissing it. I just don't want to say his name, okay? There's a flash of something in his eyes, an emotion she can't quite read. Is he offended? Did she bruise his Harvard-educated ego? She doesn't have the energy to apologize just yet, because she's seeing Jason Briffle all over again. His ruddy-cheeked baby face and his mess of dirty blonde curls. The way he used to linger too long next to the signing table after the events she did with her dad. His hungry, probing looks as he fingered the latest copy of her dad's book, which he'd just purchased, yet again, so he could secure a place in line and have an excuse to get close to her. How many times had she told her dad she thought the guy was stranger than the rest? When he'd reach the table, he'd fall to a crouch so they could be at eye level with each other. And he'd start asking her all kinds of concerned questions about how she was holding up, as if her rescue had been only months before, and not years. And then there was the time he'd tried to reach for her hand. She'd withdrawn it quickly, and something dark had flashed in his eyes.
Her father had dismissed her concerns, of course. He hadn't taken them half as seriously as he did the computer hacks they were subjected to by crime scene junkies searching for proof she was lying about what she'd had to do on that farm. When it came to Jason Briffle, her father had just given her some lecture about how they couldn't control who their work touched. To this day, she isn't sure if her dad really believed, or still believes his old pabulum, that those leering horror movie fans were truly concerned with the psychology of serial killers, that they came to their events so they could learn how to protect themselves and their loved ones from psychopaths, not just to savor the gory details of the Bannings' crimes, to worship the dark mystique in which those awful movies had shrouded her. Then Briffle had found their address. That's when the letters started. It was her dad's fault. Something with how he'd registered to vote in his district that had made his address available to the public. And as she'd read the first letter, she'd realized where all Briffle's concerned questions came from. He wasn't worried she'd been traumatized by her time with the Bannings. In his twisted mind, the trauma was that she had been removed from the Bannings' care, as he put it, her destiny thwarted. The letters contained crime scene photos, some real, some fake, all designed to stir memories of her time on the farm, even though she'd never personally laid eyes on any of the victims. He included passages from letters Abigail had exchanged with him, letters in which she'd praised the work he was trying to do to reawaken Trina to her destiny. If she hadn't alerted her father's publisher herself, nothing would have changed. When Stonecutter Books found out about their young star's stalker, they'd insisted her father relocate them, and they'd contributed to the expense of extra security at their events. They'd also provided legal assistance so Charlotte could go about filing a restraining order. Now, thanks to the work she's done in this tiny office with this exceedingly handsome man, she can see that it was her father's refusal to treat Briffle as a threat that had caused her to go so far off script that fateful day at Burnham College. Because that's when she'd realized, as long as they kept doing those events, there would be more Jasons. That's when she decided she could never set foot on stage with her father again. 3 years had passed between the evening security escorted Jason out of the event and the sunny afternoon he appeared on Grandma Luann's front porch in Altamira. Now it's been twice that. Maybe Jason's moved on to a new obsession. If changing her name and moving to the middle of nowhere doesn't make her feel safe, then nothing will. "Sorry," she says. "I didn't mean to snap like that."
"It's fine," Dylan says. "How are you sleeping?"
"Badly. Ever since I saw the..."
She gestures to the window behind her, to the marquee across the street.
"You know."
"Is it affecting your work?"
"I work from home in my pajamas, so not really."
"I'm aware your clients can't see the bags under your eyes, but is it having an impact on your ability to keep up with your call load?"
"I have bags under my eyes?" she asks.
"Charlie, is it affecting your work?" She sucks in her best attempt at a deep breath. It turns into a shallow grunt.
"The other day I got a client's origin city mixed up with the one from the previous call."
"What does that mean?"
he asks. "It means I booked him a ticket from Singapore to Boston instead of Paris to Boston."
"I understand those cities are very far apart."
"Yeah, well, on a computer screen, they're just a bunch of letters and airport codes, you know?"
"Especially if you haven't had any sleep."
"I caught it before he left for the airport. Got him on a flight that left the next day. Put in a comp request for an extra night at the hotel."
"Has he complained?"
"Survey reviews at the end of each month, we'll see."
Dylan nods.
"I don't want to take anything, Doc," she says, once the silence between them becomes uncomfortable.
"All right, well, let's talk about that."
"I don't want to swallow a bunch of pills just to feel normal."
"That's not exactly an accurate description of the treatment options we've discussed,"
Please, I don't want to talk about it.
That's exactly why we should talk about it. It's not about the medication. It's about your belief that accepting that kind of help is admitting unacceptable weakness.
There's no pill out there that's going to change my past.
True, but we're not talking about your past.
Then what are we talking about?
We're talking about a bridge, Charlie. A temporary solution that will allow you to get some sleep. That will reduce your anxiety just enough so you can leave the house for longer than it takes to come here or run to the grocery store. Maybe for as long as it takes to start forming some meaningful social relationships. Once you get in the habit of those things, they'll be easier to do in the long term. Any medications we explore would be about helping you take the leap.
A bridge? A leap? Which one is it, Doc? How sad is it that making conversation with the checker at the grocery store is taking a leap? She asks.
Charlotte, you were kidnapped as a baby. Your mother was murdered. You were held hostage for 7 years by 2 psychopaths who isolated you from the world, who lied to you about who you were, who tried to turn you into someone like them. And when you were returned to your father, he exploited you at every turn and without your consent. And, ironically, none of these traumas in your past are the source of your current anxiety.
You're kidding, right?
I'm not. These events I just listed, they've made you incredibly strong. Resourceful, even.
Her expression must betray her doubt, because he sits forward, planting his elbows on his knees.
Charlie, you emancipated yourself from your father as a teenager after you rejected his agenda for you in front of an audience of hundreds. As an adult, you went on to sue him, successfully, I might add, for money that was rightfully yours. Money that allowed you to change your name and relocate. These are not the actions of a broken bird, Charlie. You're tired for sure. You're tired and you're still grieving your grandmother. Those two conditions have tricked you into believing you're weak. And the longer you stay barricaded in that house, the bigger this lie becomes in your head.
How long has he been waiting to say this to her? It's the first time she's seen him look nervous. On edge, even. Maybe he's afraid she'll walk out.
You can admit that what happened to you made you stronger without celebrating the people who did those things to you. But to do that, you're going to need a bigger push than I can give you in here.
Maybe this is why she keeps coming back to Dr. Thorpe. Because he's the first person she's met in years who can make her cry just by stating the truth. And if I can cry, she thinks, if I can cry, then I'm not the sick and damaged killer those movies made everyone believe I was. His expression is fixed as he reaches across his desk and hands her a box of tissues. There's a soft buzz that sounds like it's coming from her phone, but when she looks to where she thought she left it, on the edge of Thorpe's desk, it's not there.
It's mine, Dylan says. Sorry, I thought I turned it off.
Where's mine?
Stay focused, Charlie. I think we're on to something here.
Okay. It's hard to focus right now.
Because you need some sleep?
Yeah, she finally says. I need some sleep.
What, Charlie?
There were pills before. Dylan seems genuinely concerned. For Christ's sake, it's not like she's about to disclose she was molested. But that's how he's acting.
You've tried medication before? He asks.
My father tried medication. On me. When I was 10. Dylan nods, and his expression is grim.
And what prompted your father to put you on medication back then?
I started complaining. About the appearances. The movies.
I see.
Do you?
Your father drugged you to silence you. And so you're afraid that's what I'm trying to do to you now.
It's not like it worked. I started hiding the drugs after a few weeks.
But you stopped complaining, didn't you?
for a while.
From age 10 to age 16 is a long while.
I guess.
Christ, she sounds 16. She's even staring down at her lap now like a sullen teenager. I'm not trying to silence you, Charlie. I didn't reach out to you and offer my ear because I thought what you needed was more silence, quite the opposite, in fact. And I can assure you that if you decide to go the medication route this time, it'll be entirely different.
How can you assure me of that?
Because this time, the choice will be yours.
3. Access denied. Jason isn't surprised when these words appear on the keypad's display. He never expected to crack her code on the first try. There's no telling exactly what type of security system she has. She hasn't posted a sign next to her driveway like a suburban family would. She doesn't really have a driveway. Just a strip of tire-scuffed earth that looks a little smoother than the surrounding desert. It leads to a reinforced steel garage door that, like the rest of her squat, one-story stucco house, is painted the common colors of the Sonoran. The paint does its job. The house is pretty much camouflaged from the nearest road. But he had no trouble finding the place with the directions the Savior gave him. Given his research into alarm systems, he figures he's got about 3 more tries before he's locked out or the alarm company alerts local law enforcement. The nearest police station is just inside the Scarlet Town Line, a 30-minute drive away. So, if he does get locked out, he'll have time to race back to the dried-out arroyo where he hid his car. Then he'll have to reassess. He has to teach Trina that her defenses against him are useless, and he can only do that by getting inside her house, by showing her that he belongs there, that their union is inevitable. On the basis of his emails, the Savior seems to understand this. He sent Jason a list of possible code words, objects and places with a special meaning to her, terse descriptions of her favorite memories, and strings of relevant numbers. Her birthday, her birth mother's birthday. That might be the basis of her alarm code. If he cracks the code, he's in. She's afraid of keys, the Savior told him. They're too easily lost, too easily stolen or copied. The idea behind a security system like hers is to make sure no door is ever left unlocked by mistake, and to eliminate any exposed mechanisms that might allow an intruder access to the locks themselves. The cylinder inside each is several inches deeper than your average deadbolt, too deep to be jimmied open by even the most skilled locksmith. And in the absence of a key mechanism, you'd have to tear apart the door frame or the adjacent wall to even try for access to the lock itself. The code unlocks a specific series of doors for several minutes, and then they lock again automatically. It's the kind of system usually reserved for vaults or other storage facilities that rarely see human visitors. And Trina's installed it in her own home. Can she not see how desperate this is? How it smacks of someone denying the inevitable? Chances are the system includes smoke detectors that disengage all the locks in case of a fire. But what if something else happened to her out here? What if she had a heart attack or was bitten by a snake and she couldn't enter the code and so EMS couldn't get to her? Stupid. So stupid. Not stupid, he reminds himself. Just misguided, that's all. He scans the words and numbers again. The meaning of some are clear to him thanks to his study of Lowell Pierce's book. Bluebird, for instance. Joyce Collins, her birth mother's maiden name. But the others he doesn't understand. As he reads over them now, he feels a surge of jealousy. The Savior knows why these words are precious to her. The Savior knows more about her than Jason's managed to learn in a decade. Whoever the Savior is, they've come to the same conclusion Jason did years ago. That Trina was taught the cleansing power of murder at a young age, and with every day she refuses to put this lesson to good use, her soul dies a little bit more. As evidenced by this secluded prison in which she now lives. It's literally in the middle of nowhere, this tiny house, surrounded by parched desert sliced by arroyos and dotted with sparse stands of blue Palo Verde trees that only give teasers of shade. On his walk in, he'd passed the old fence lines, spotted a few crumbling stakes. His internet research into the area told him this used to be part of a sprawling housing complex for the workers in the copper mine just up the road, which probably explains its water and electrical lines. But the mine's been closed for years, and most of the houses were abandoned after a big fire swept through the area. Trina's is the only one within view. The courtyard sits between the solid metal entry door and the front door of the house itself, which he can't see from where he stands. The wall is 8 feet high. She poured a river of concrete along the top and studded it with huge, jagged shards of glass that give off rainbow reflections in the dusk. Did she set each piece by hand? If so, she didn't do it to keep out snakes. She did it to stop him. And so the sight of all that jagged glass now makes him angry. But if he gets angry, he'll get distracted. And that's unacceptable. B. Bird 474. It feels like a wild guess, but it isn't really. The code's the average length of most computer passwords, 8 characters with a mix of letters and numbers. And how many times did he sit in the audience and listen to her tell the story of how she came to see the bluebird, the one she didn't kill, as a symbol of her rebirth? As for the numbers, 474 are the last 3 digits of her mother's birthday, if you chop off the month, which is March. And in all her years of signing his books, her handwriting would always place the emphasis on the final letters in her name, and not the first. As if her hand always needed a second or two to gather energy before exploding with it at the end. That's why he's assumed she would cut off some of the first few letters of the word bluebird and drop the number of the month in the sequence of digits in her mother's birthday. And it's wrong. Which shouldn't surprise him. When it comes to Trina's life story, bluebird isn't the most secret of passwords. How many times did he sit in the audience and listen to her tell that story? About the bird flying out of her hands right as the SWAT team exploded out of the woods. He's not willing to jettison the rest of his guess. Not yet. He refuses to believe Trina has let go of her birth mother, and that's part of her problem, her inability to see her mother's death as a necessary sacrifice, a fundamental aspect of her rebirth. When it comes to the code, he just needs a word, a token, a thing from her more recent, and more secret, past. The life she made for herself after she legally changed her name and disappeared from that town in California where her grandmother's friends had threatened to beat him to a pulp if he ever came back again. He consults the list. Altamira. Luann, grandmother. Bayard Rock, Altamira landmark used to visit with grandmother on her walks. Fisher Pit, copper mine near her house, closed 1986. While he's sure Bayard Rock is probably the most meaningful item on the list, it's not exactly secret, a local landmark in a town where she lived while she was still Trina. And Fisher Pit, which is just up the road, isn't exactly the most covert either. He should just wait. He should just wait until her headlights appear out of the darkness and then slip in through the reinforced steel garage door as soon as she opens it. It won't be the easiest maneuver, but it's doable. But where would he hide until then? There are no trees close to the house. There's pretty much nothing close to the house. The nearest arroyo where he hid his car is a 15-minute walk if he moves at a clip. Way too far for him to make it through the garage door before it closes. And that's the idea, isn't it? Nothing but wide open desert on all sides of the house. No obstructions,
easily surveyed with the night vision cameras she's got attached to her security system. I have to get in.